You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for the in-depth section of the program. Is Israel suffering from an economic crisis? You bet it is. How much of a crisis, though, is it suffering from? Well, it was enough for Moody's to actually downgrade its credit rating. That much we know. In this in-depth section, we're going to take a look at other aspects of Israel's economy which point to this crisis. Our first look is a comparison of Israel's gross domestic budget deficit between the years 2023 and 2022. Now, when you take a look at this budget deficit for 2023, it has come in at 4.2%. That equals $20.7 billion. Now, that is while in the year 2022, it saw a surplus of 0.6%. So it's no surprise that the deficit jumped by 0.8% in December to the figure 4.2% at the height of the Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip. Now, as we have done in previous programs, Israel's aggression spending has been spiraling out of control, but we need to take a look at it. One figure has put that aggression cost, with the figure being at $59.3 billion, as you see there. It put the daily cost at around $269 million daily. Some figures actually have put that figure at a lot higher. We took this from the Times of Israel, where Israel has cited that. Next, this is where Israel is getting into trouble, since it is having a hard time keeping up with the costs, especially military ones. Now, to pay for the military spending, one of the things it had to do was it had to increase it by $18.6 billion. When that is compared to Israel's revenues, like let's say from taxes, well, it's easy to see why Israel is falling short. Israeli tax revenues for the year 2023 was $30 billion lower than projected. And finally, consumer confidence is really important. At this point, Israel is suffering from that. And it has fallen quite a bit due to the aggression. And now that the aggression keeps dragging on, it keeps decreasing the consumer confidence. Inflation, as a result, is now a very major concern. Israel has put the inflation percentage somewhere in the vicinity of, to have risen to 5.3%. There's some of the other areas where the Bank of Israel has come into play. A fiscal discipline is recommending reduction in spending and, of course, taxes to be raised. And finally, in terms of the concerns that Israel has, well, the aggression is going to continue from what we're seeing right now, especially rhetoric coming out of the defiant Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And then we have the Red Sea shipping crisis, which adds to the economic worries for Israel. All right, let's bring back our guests and find out what they think and what direction Israel's economy is going to be going. Arturo Hartman-Pacheco rejoins us, researcher in international relations with a focus on Palestine and Israel. Welcome back to the program. I'd like to get an idea from you when it comes to the illegal settlements, but these are areas in Israel, especially in the northern part, where there is an agricultural concentration. In terms of what happens there, obviously, you have a production that takes place there. The food basket production obviously is a big worry now for Israel because it's been impacted so hard based on the genocidal war. Extensive damage to this sector, which has prevented ultimately food production. What is your outlook on this sector? Where is it heading to?
Well, there's a lot of things that we can unpack here. The main workforce laboring in the agricultural sector and harvesting and cultivating are Palestinians from the West Bank, legally, between commas here, between quotes here, and illegally. So you already have a big impact on the agricultural sector. And the problem with agriculture is that you can lose harvests if you don't work on that. So this is the first thing. But also we have to look the impact over to the Palestinians, right? So Palestine, and I'm not talking about Gaza, okay? I'm talking about the West Bank. You're going to have a dilemma because of the occupation, the illegal occupation over the West Bank, One of the methods is that you link the Israeli economy to the Palestinian economy, which is illegal under international humanitarian law and occupation law. You're going to have a problem of supply to the Palestinians for the Israeli product that even if they try to boycott, they are cheaper and they offer more supply. But also for the salaries, they're not being paid to the Palestinians because they are not working in Israel, or either because Israel is holding the revenues of the Palestinian Authority, so the Palestinian Authority is not paying salaries.
All right, very well. Let's bring Mark Sloboda back. Mark Sloboda is a former senior lecturer and researcher at the Faculty of Sociology of Moscow State University. Mark Sloboda, welcome back. You know, I want to get an idea from you about Israel's economy as a whole. And really, what are we looking at over here? I mean, in terms of the aggression itself, it's lasted more than 4 months now. Obviously, there's costs that are involved there, quite high. Some estimates putting it at around $269 million daily. We're looking at falling GDP. We're looking at inflation that has crept up. And all the sorts of negative economic indicators, including the Moody's downgrade, and even areas in Israel that are just empty, and businesses either are halfway closed or shut down. How bad an economic crisis is Israel facing?
I think that the drop in economic activity, the costs of the conflict, both military and economic, on the Israeli regime are fairly severe and will have to be factored into Israeli decision making about the future of the conflict going forward. The Washington Post has estimated that the war is costing the Israeli government about $250 million a day. That may very well be a severe underestimate. They also project that if the war would carry on for another few months through 2024, that the grand total cost of the conflict to the Israeli economy could be $50 billion or more. The Israeli finance ministry has been making increasingly pleading and desperate messages to Netanyahu that taxes need to be hiked. And the damage to the Israeli economy is across the board, across all sectors. Those have to do with, one, the large number of the Israeli high-tech workers, in particular, who have been called up for reservist duty. So the government not only has to pay salaries to all of the hundreds of thousands of reservists it's called up, but their services are being lost. Their labor is being lost to the economy.
One of the sectors of the Israeli economy that has suffered the most amid the onslaught is tourism, which accounted for 2.6% of the GDP before the pandemic in 2019. Prior to Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, visitors to Israel numbered above 300,000 each month. In November, that figure reportedly sank to 39,000. Construction, which ordinarily relies on Palestinian labor from the West Bank, has ground to a near halt. Israel has suspended the work permits of more than 100,000 Palestinians. A war that lasts 5 to 10 more months could cost Israel as much as $50 billion or even more. The onslaught has already taken an economic toll in these northern and southern regions of the occupied territories. Towns are emptied of people. Businesses are shuttered. Farm fields lay untended, putting production timelines in jeopardy. In short, the double economic shock on supply and demand could become an unprecedented macroeconomic crisis for Israel, with some Israeli economists estimating the accumulated cost to be 10% of the GDP if the aggression lasts for a year. The economic toll of this violence may cost Israel an estimated $400 billion in lost economic activity over the next decade. For Israel,
90% of the economic shock will come from indirect effects: reduced investment, slowing productivity growth, and labor market disruption.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matt Yaposyan. Israel's economic troubles just got worse with the downgrading of its credit rating by Moody's Investor Service. The credit rating, given by several rating firms throughout the year, is an assessment of Israel's credibility regarding its financial obligations and debt. This is the first time Moody's has lowered Israel's credit rating. Moody's downgraded Israel from A1 to A2 and said the outlook for the regime's economy was negative. Moody's concluded that the war and its aftermath will materially raise political risks for Israel for the foreseeable future. Moody's expects that Israel's debt burden will be materially higher than projected before the conflict. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has remained defiant in his response to the rating by the Moody's. This type of reaction, playing down Moody's decision, is another sign of instability within Israel. The Israeli Prime Minister said in reaction, the Israeli economy is strong, adding that the rating downgrade is not connected to the economy. It is entirely due to the fact that we are in a war. Israel's finance minister had the same type of reaction, more or less, dismissing the decision. He said the announcement reflects a lack of confidence in Israel's security and national strength, and also a lack of confidence in the righteousness of Israel's path against the enemies. But Israel's PM Netanyahu and finance minister Smotrich should be worried. Moody's downgrade could lead other major agencies also to downgrade Israel's outlook. If other agencies travel down the path, that could impact Israel's economy because it will make it harder for Israel to raise money by selling bonds. So far, Israel has amended its annual budget. It exercised a 3% budget cut across the board to try to compensate for the spike in its military operation costs. Israel is also mulling over whether it will increase value-added tax by 1% in 2025 or not. And that does it for this Quick Take section.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is being defiant, and he's also reckless at the same time for pushing ahead with this genocidal war. It's risking not only himself and Israel at the same time, but the entire West Asia region, banking on winning a genocidal war that he knows he can't win. After all, he has not achieved any of his stated goals, from releasing the captives or to eliminating Hamas. At the same time, Israel is bleeding money. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Thank you so much for being with us. Hope you enjoyed it. From Ikova Tahwe and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright. and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Dear listeners, let's listen to the first to third verses of the chapter.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
طاسين. تلك آيات القرآن وكتاب مبين.
طاسين. These are the verses of the Quran and a clear book.
هدى وبشرى للمؤمنين.
As guidance and good tidings for the believers.
الذين يقيمون الصلاة ويؤتون الزكاة وهم بالآخرة هم يوقنون.
Who establish prayer and give zakah, and of the hereafter they are certain in faith.
Now, these are the beginning verses of Surah An-Naml. In the previous episode, we said that the word mubin is derived from ibana, and it is both transitive and intransitive, which means clear and to make things clear. So, also, another word which is used in these verses is the word zakat. This Quranic word contains two main meanings. One of them is the proper meaning, which is known as poor rate, or the zakat that we already know, and the other is the general meaning, which means to help the needy. This helping the poor is also called zakat, and it can be in any form and manner possible. So, in this holy verse, the latter one is meant. I mean, in this verse where it says, الَّذِينَ يُقِيمُونَ الصَّلَاةَ وَيُؤْتُونَ الزَّكَاةَ وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ يُوقِنُونَ. This word zakah used in this verse, it seems to be that this surah had been sent down in Medina. So, the formal order of zakat was issued. However, as we said, it still requires that such a creator who has brought such a beautiful sacred relic into the being of such simple items be praised. So we have, of course, discussed in details about the beginnings of different chapters of the Holy Quran that begin with the abbreviated letters. So, as we said, Quran seems to be really associated with the beginning of this surah, since right after the beginning letters, Ta-Sin, it is the word about the Holy Quran. تِلْكَ آيَاتُ الْقُرْآنِ وَكِتَابٍ مُبِينٍ. So that is why we say that its creator needs to be praised. And we have discussed in detail some of the other chapters of the Holy Quran that begin with these abbreviated letters.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Some of the commentators have said that probably the words Quran and also Kitabin Mubin, which is translated into the book which is manifest or the book which makes things manifest, anyway, these two words, Qur'an and Kitabin Mubin, some commentators have said that these two refer to two separate things. The latter, Kitabin Mubin, indicates to Lawhun Mahfuz, which is the protected tablet, but the apparent of these verses, and this verse specifically, shows that both of them speak of one thing. One of them is in the form of utterances and recitation, and the other is in the form of a written book. In the second noble verse, there have been stated two other qualities for the Qur'an. So in the beginning verse, we saw Ayatul Qur'an wa Kitabin Mubin. This Qur'an is Kitabin Mubin. It is a book that makes things manifest, and it is also manifest itself, and it has other characteristics. Hudan wa bushra lil mu'minin, the second verse says, a guidance and glad tidings for the believers. So, the application of the word tilka in this verse, in the beginning verse, is stating the greatness of these heavenly verses. And the Quranic word mubin used for the Quran is an emphasis indicating that Quran is both clear and makes the facts clear. And as we said, in the second verse, it says a guidance and glad tidings for the believers. And who are these believers? In the third verse, they are announced, those who establish prayer and give zakat. So their belief in both the origin and resurrection is firm, and their link with Allah and His servants is strong. We'll continue our discussions in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, Take care.
Things goodbye. Always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Because we're waiting for a living imam, you've noticed all around, meaning in our community locally and globally, you see believers, mu'mineen and mu'minat, making effort to commemorate this event. So you have people reciting poetry, which is great. You have people hosting mu'mineen and mu'minat, absolutely important. We'll have some people reciting Salam, Ya Mahdi. That's also, we have to have these kind of things. The question is this, what's the most important thing we need to do for the imam to return? All of those are great, and we have to do those. But our question tonight to ask ourselves, and inshallah, the three points that we want to kind of focus on tonight will be with that outlook. What is it that the imam needs from us? You see, they teach us this, true intidhar, or waiting for the imam, means that you and I have to identify what are the traits that our imam needs us to have. For instance, our imam is going to establish justice. We have to be working towards that. Our imam needs ikhlas. We have to be working on our ikhlas, right? We have to be working on the traits that our imam needs then now. We have to create the grounds, be those people who are ready for the imam by having the traits that the imam wants then now. Meaning we have to create the grounds. That's on us. Having said that, our question that we want to ask ourselves is, what is it that the imam really needs? What is it that even if we are reciting dua nutba and we are crying our eyes out, we are offering food, gifts, these kind of things, but without this, the imam won't return. We're looking for that. So inshallah, we want to take three lessons, three reminders, of course, obviously, first for myself, but then for all of you, and then also to share with others, inshallah, in order to do our responsibility. So instead of us only looking to the imam today, last night, for dua, for our needs, this time, what does he need from us? So brothers and sisters, we usually go over the ayat of the Quran together. I'm going to share one verse of the Quran about this perspective. What does God need? What does the imam need? And I'll ask brothers and sisters, as usual, to see if they can find this verse in the Quran or on your phones, and we'll read this verse together. Okay, so brothers and sisters, see if you can turn to Surah Baqarah and verse number 245. Let's see if I'm quoting this verse correctly. Remember the question, though. The question is, what does God need from us? Or in our case, what does the imam need from us? So let's read this verse together. We're looking at the Arabic, and then we'll read the translation together. God is asking, who is it? مَنْ ذَلَّذِي يُقْرِضُ اللَّهُ قَرْضًا حَسَنًا. Who is it who will give God a goodly loan. Right? How can we help? Who will give God a loan? If we do that for you, ضَعِفَهُ لَهُ عَضَافًا كَثِيرًا. If you do that, then God will multiply what you do in His way multiple times. We're looking for the idea of what do I need to do for the Imam? Three lessons. The first lesson, well, I'm just going to kind of run over them and I'll see if I can cover all of them in 15 minutes and 45 seconds. Number one is connecting the dots. Why is it so necessary if we're working for the dhuhr of the Imam to connect the dots and talk about current events? Number one. Number two, what is the prophetic approach to the clarification jihad? I've talked before about the idea of the clarification jihad, the idea that you and I, we have one responsibility to first learn Islam, to embrace Islam, to implement Islam, but then after that, we also have a responsibility to spread the teachings of Islam as is in smaller circles. So the prophetic approach of our prophet when it comes to the clarification jihad. Number three, we're going to deconstruct one of the greatest obstacles to the return of the Imam. For this one, I'm going to give the reference in the book so brothers and sisters can read ahead and find out what that greatest obstacle is. And then all of us collectively and individually will work on trying to deconstruct that biggest obstacle to the, one of the biggest obstacles to the return of the Imam. So we'll start with the first one. The first one, brothers and sisters, is why is it so necessary when we have a religious gathering? We're here. We could just talk about the 12th Imam. We could talk about when he was born. We could talk about who his mother was. We could talk about a lot of things. We wouldn't necessarily, we could have a session like this and not connect it to current events at all and go home and everybody would feel good. But what happened over here? Yes, Quds is a big thing. We have to prepare for Quds from now. We have to prepare our children for Quds. More than that, one other current event. Why is it that we would connect these events to the coming of the Imam? Isn't it okay? Let's just talk about the Imam and not bring anything current into it. Keep it clean. Part of the reason that people will tell us not to talk about these things is they say you've just got to be smart. Don't poke the bear. Just keep your nose clean. Don't talk about these kind of events. Quds. Just keep your nose clean. Everybody knows our stance on Quds. Don't connect the dots. Don't speak up for the oppressed. Don't make it that the coming of the Imam means you have to teach your children about Quds. Don't do that. Why? Because it's smart. You got to be smart. The problem with that, brothers and sisters, this is the first lesson for today. Brothers and sisters, I'll be absolutely honest with you. There is a price for resistance. Resistance, not rolling over, because people advise you, just roll over. Don't say anything. There is a price for resistance. But the price for surrender is a lot greater. So there's a price for surrender. There's also a price for resistance. But the price for surrender is a lot greater. And I want to give you some hadith about this. And then after that, some examples about this. And we'll move on to our next question. So we're answering, well, why is it that we have to mention that brother? Okay? Let's learn the principle. Now, this is from Imam Sadiq. So the Imam says this. Man mana'a haqqan lillah. Whoever prevents, stops a right that God has. Man mana'a haqqan lillah azza wa jal anfaqa fi batilin mithlay. This person will spend twice what they could have spent for haqq in batil. There's still a price, but it's more if you surrender. hadith. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, a socket. So they advise us, be silent. Don't connect the dots, right? Imam Ali says, a socket. The person who's silent, akhuradi. When I'm neutral, when I don't take a side, I actually am taking a side. And I'm taking the side of the zalim. Right? Imam says this, وَمَنْ لَمْ يَكُمْ مَعَنَا كَانَ عَلَيْنَا. Those who aren't with us are against us.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahim Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mateen Ghafur Shakur Wadud Qayyum Rauf Sabur Majid. محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
The Zionist regime continues to inflict conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of Palestinians in Gaza by attacking hospitals, a key feature of its military campaign across the territory. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, some of the most vulnerable of Palestinians in Gaza have lost their lives during the siege on Nasser Medical Complex. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said recently that 5 patients in intensive care had died after their oxygen supply had run out. The World Health Organization said that it was attempting to gain access to the hospital where there are still critically injured and sick patients. Earlier in the day, the health ministry reported that Israeli regime troops had detained a World Health Organization convoy carrying fuel, water, and food outside the medical complex. The ministry said later in the day that the Israeli regime troops had detained and were interrogating a large number of medical personnel, patients, and displaced people in the hospital's maternity building, which they had turned into a military barracks. Doctors Without Borders said that Israeli regime forces shelled Nasser Medical Complex recently, and its staff at the facility reported a chaotic situation with an undetermined number of people killed and injured. The organization said that one of its staff were abducted by Israeli regime troops at a checkpoint where they were screening people leaving the hospital. They said that he remains unaccounted for. Recently, Medical Aid for Palestinians said that 2 women had given birth at Nasser Medical Complex in dire conditions, without electricity, water, food, and heating, and that Israeli regime troops forced women and children to move into the maternity building, which is under military siege. Physicians for Human Rights said recently that the evacuation orders issued before the devastating assault on Nasser Medical Complex did not provide any adequate response to guarantee the safe transfer of patients and staff. Beyond assurances that it will avoid harming evacuees, the rights group added Israel must ensure the availability of intensive care ambulances and secure alternative medical facilities for the complex medical needs of these patients. The group said that given the collapse of Gaza's healthcare system, the forced evacuation of Nasser Medical Complex blatantly contradicts the International Court of Justice order for Israel to take immediate action to prevent catastrophe. The Zionist regime's military said recently it had abducted more than 20 people at Nasser Medical Complex who they claimed were involved in October 7th events. The military stated on its Telegram channel that its precise and limited operation at the complex is based on intelligence that the activity is being carried out from within the hospital. OCGAT, an Israeli regime military unit that has played a central role in comprehensive siege imposed on Gaza since 2007 and the resulting deterioration of the capacity of the healthcare system in the territory, claimed that Hamas had turned Nasser Medical Complex into one of their command centers. The child killer regime of Israel has made similar unsubstantiated claims regarding other health facilities it has attacked in Gaza over the past 4 months. While the Zionist regime claims that its operations in Gaza are focused on eliminating the resistance movements, pattern of attacks and the scale of destruction points to a deliberate campaign to wipe out civilian infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, thus rendering it uninhabitable. Beyond the tens of thousands killed and injured, modern medical care has largely come to a standstill for 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza. They note that even before the current aggression, life expectancy in Gaza was already 10 years shorter than people living a few miles away in the Palestinian occupied territories, while the rates of neonatal, infant, and maternal mortality were nearly 5 times higher. The authors added that the combination of forced mass displacement, unhygienic conditions caused by interrupted sanitation services and sewage treatment, and interrupted vaccination will inevitably drive disease outbreaks in the future, functionally resulting in a form of indirect biological warfare. The French charity Doctors of the World said recently that its Gaza City offices, clearly marked and known by Israeli regime authorities to house a humanitarian organization, had been deliberately demolished days earlier. A staff member of the humanitarian group had been sheltering in the offices along with his family, Doctors of the World said. According to the group, they had boarded themselves in with office cabinets and didn't dare go outside for fear of being shot at. While many civilians were killed around the building, which was surrounded by explosions, troops entered the offices in early February and removed elderly people, women and children, and humiliated and degraded the men present by forcing them to come out naked. The Doctors of the World offices were destroyed at an undetermined point after the forced evacuation. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said recently that its hospital in Khan Yunis was targeted by Israeli regime tank fire, resulting in severe damage but no injuries. The humanitarian group added, tanks have been stationed outside Al Amal Hospital for 2 weeks, preventing the entry of any aid or logistical supplies. The Red Crescent said that two of its doctors had been released after they were abducted by troops during a raid on Al Amal 1 week earlier. 12 Red Crescent team members remain under arrest, including 7 who were arrested at Al Amal Hospital, the humanitarian group said. 9 elderly patients who couldn't be evacuated were abducted, along with their companions, when the hospital was raided on February 9th. The Red Crescent rejected the Zionist regime's claim that it had abducted 20 terrorists when it stormed the facility, calling the allegation a poor attempt to justify their commission of war crimes. The Red Crescent announced recently that despite the siege on Al Amal, its team successfully carried out an emergency S-section for a pregnant woman.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, The Viewpoints. Here in the studio, I am with Brother Ali and Sheikh Agha Mohammadi, Islamic scholars and researchers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, brother. Thanks for inviting me to this show.
There are people in the society that they see that it's impossible to have worldly ideals along with religion. They say that there are two things separated. And the people who support this idea or some people who disagree. So, you know, some people find it difficult to balance between these two. I mean, sometimes they, go fast. Sometimes they, it's so hard to find the balance, to have a balance between these two extremes I mentioned. How? And can believers find this balance finally?
Yeah. In the practice, yeah, that's a fact that it's not easy. So to do that, people first, they have to learn. They have to be trained. Sometimes, unfortunately, we see that the religion and Islam, we're talking specifically about Islam, it is limited to some rituals, to some rulings of fiqh. While the greater side of it is the lifestyle, that is to a large extent is ignored. So we need a pure society. A pure society is to pave the way for the believers to have a good lifestyle and to have a good social and individual life according to the teachings of Islam. Then you will see that it can happen and it's not something impossible. Even to study the life that they have. I mean, sometimes they say that why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran refers to this fact that the prophet, we sent a prophet who came to you enjoining to the goodness, forbidding evil, and prohibiting some specific impurities and making purities halal. Then Allah says, then he will remove the shackles and chains from you. He will give you freedom. So this is the function of religion. This is not about akhirah.
So this
is about the material life.
This is about
the material life. In the material life, when you practice religion, at the beginning there must be some do's and don'ts. You just do not judge the religion by do's and don'ts to say that, it's a burden. This is how, unfortunately, the problem is that they see it as a burden. But when you practice this do's and don'ts, Allah says the result is that you will have freedom. And this is what in politics they call it positive freedom versus negative freedom. Negative freedom is what liberalism, you know, promotes. Negative freedom means that there is no one with a stick to push you to do something. Mm. So you see that right now in the world, what the world that we are living in, people are forced to live a specific life, but there is no stick. The ladies should wear a specific makeup and a specific clothing, and the youth, you see that every there was a kind of a style, that a kind of a status symbol for the youth for some years, that they used to wear even today the ripped jeans with lots of holes on it. Mm. 20 years ago, it was crazy if you told people that you will pay money to wear jeans which is ripped. This is nonsense. But they make you. This is negative freedom. It means that nobody is there with a stick, but they brainwash you. Mm. But in Islam, Allah, the positive freedom is that from the very first day, they say, do this, don't do this. I'm limiting you, but this is freedom for. Means that there is a purpose behind these limitations. Mm. I have seen in different countries that I was there, I don't want to mention the names. You see, alcohol, for example, in Islam, alcohol is abandoned. So for many people, it might look difficult not to drink alcohol, not to drink wine. But when you look at the life, especially at the pandemic, which was there, the COVID, they banned, you know, selling alcohol. Mm-hmm. So it became a black market.
Oh, yeah.
Why? Because it is harmful. I had a friend in hospital, and he said that on the weekends, because at the weekends, people drink a lot. He said the great department in the hospital we are is dedicated to injured people. Mm. To dispatch the why? Because people come injured. The man is drunk and they break the bottle and they hurt their ladies, their own wives, their children, because the man is out of his mind. Lots of accidents happen on weekends because people are driving while they are drunk. Mm-hmm. So you see that even if they look at the damages that it has for the body, There was a kind of statistics why Muslims live longer life in Russia in comparison to Christians. One of the main elements is because Muslims do not drink. The Christians, they say that because Russia is very cold, we drink vodka, then it makes it hot. Mm. So it destroys them from inside. And Muslims have longer life in comparison. One of the elements is because they don't drink. So, I mean, even if you look at the from the materialistic perspective, then you will see that this is the right thing. It's giving you freedom. So, I mean, the training should be there and people should learn. Then you will see that there is no conflict in practice. Of course, the temptations will be there. But by appealing to the rulings, then you will see that at the end, you will have the positive freedom, means the better life, the better lifestyle.
So, you mean paying attention to do's and don'ts, we gradually find our balance in life.
That's true.
Lifestyle.
That's true. And that is the whole religion is. You see that always in all Salatul Jum'ah, the khutaba, those who are delivering the lecture, they refer to this hadith of Imam Ali salam, "Usikum bitaqwa Allah wa nazma amrikum." Actually, taqwa is to observe the do's and don'ts, and nazm that comes after taqwa is the social taqwa.
So
nazm, you can describe nazm as social taqwa.
So this order, this balance, this comes when there is some do's and don'ts. Yeah. And without them,
and give order
to the
life.
You can't find balance without them.
That's the point.
It's meaningless.
That's the point.
It's meaningless. Thank you. And let's go back to our brother Ali here in the office. Can you answer this question that some of our listeners may have? Islam was born, correct me if I'm wrong, 1,400 years ago. Does it fit in our society? Shouldn't it be updated? Or can it be updated on a daily basis?
Yeah. Yes, we have heard a lot of such sentences and the sentences alike. Like, for example, it might not have the same functionality that it had, for example, 1,400 years ago, and it's like addicting the nations and many other statements. But they need to be answered in this way that, look, Islam, which we claim that is the most perfect religion among the religions and the last of the religions, has already actually provided all the needs for a perfect life. And the needs and requirements have been seen inside it. But due to the changes of the time and due to the requirements of the time and place, also Islam has its own, again, expediency inside it. That is, by power of inference or ijtihad inside it, even the problems of the day are being answered. I mean, there is no worry about this. Islam, which is being made of ahkam, decrees and laws, or let's say regulations, aqaid, beliefs and akhlaq, moralities. So there are a set of fixed principles inside the rules and regulations of Islam in these three branches. But due to the expediency and the needs and requirements of time and place, some changes can happen inside them. For example, but not in the fixed beliefs, I mean. In the beliefs, there is no change. Whatever has come, even the Imam and the Prophet cannot change the believing system that has been legislated by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right? So even those who are claiming such a thing, they are usually worried about the issues that they have in their daily lives. So as for those issues, Islam gave a power to the expert of Islam, to the Islamic authorities, by this tool, that is the tool of ijtihad or inference, to infer from the basis. We have certain bases. We have mabani, that is basis or principles, that through understanding them, this person who is an expert in Islamic laws and Islamic beliefs can understand, can legislate, can issue the verdict or decree which is needed for the same issue that the people are afflicted with. So there is no, I want to emphasize that there is no deadlock in Islamic beliefs and Islamic, in practicing Islamic laws and regulations. I mean, there is no issue that we face, for example, that, and Islam is silent in answering or in helping us
Way? Can I say it in this way? Islam and its practices are an answer to the needs. And needs do not change over time. The needs are fixed.
Definitely. I mean, look, maybe the kind of
not
need
once.
That we have...
I mean, not once. Yeah.
Look, maybe some of the needs are quite new needs and we don't know how to tackle them. I mean, want to say that even through the basics, through, I call them primary laws, in comparison to the secondary laws, based on the understanding that this Islamic expert, who is known as Islamic authority, has gained by these primary laws, he can actually infer the answer for any kind of issues that happens to the people.
Yeah, you know, I'm just the thing I was trying to ask you was this: sometimes we have these needs. Sometimes we have these wants. So we can replace wants. For example, I want a sandwich. Okay, do you want something else? Maybe the sandwich is not good for me. Or I can replace it with something else. So it changes over time.
True.
But the needs, when I'm thirsty, the only thing that can help me, that can satisfy me is water. I cannot replace it with soda or something else. So the thing I was asking you is this. Maybe the needs change, but the wants... any thoughts?
As I said, for a human being, there are different kinds of issues. The issues that usually human beings are afflicted with are in two types. Either they are from primary ones, primary level, or the first, or the fixed levels, or the fixed or primary needs and requirements. Or second, the things that human beings usually have and they change in the course of history, in the course of time. Like, for example, from the first level, let me give you an example from the primary ones. Mm. The belief in Allah, or the need for having, let's say, a believing system. Or the need to have some, let's say, access to the ahkam and akhlaq, or moralities, where some to some extent are fixed. As for moralities, when I'm saying that they are some, they are to some extent they are fixed, it depends. I mean, sometimes I want just to have a blank place for the issues that usually are controversial that I don't want to get into. Like, for example, the lie. For example, lying is something forbidden, but for the to save the one's life, usually lying is not forbidden then, because you are going to save one's life. So in this issue that are controversial, I don't want to get into those issues as well. But some issues like, for example, the kind of vehicle that you use to go to your work. Sometimes it is a bicycle, later on it becomes a car, I don't know, in future it might become an airplane or something else. So they are different. I mean, these secondary kinds of needs, the issues that are related to such secondary levels can be answered very easily through the tool of ijtihad. And okay. It is quite open, and so the hands of the expert is open in answering.
Yeah, so you believe that by ijtihad we have this system to update. Islam has this system to update itself. And this is...
Actually, Islam is not being updated because Islam is there, but through the basics we can understand and we can infer for any kind of issue that we have at our time.
So, yeah.
I mean, because Islam has